Welcome to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. Today I'm doubly blessed. I have two very distinguished guests, two special people. One will join us at the bottom of the hour. Let me tell you briefly about him. His name is Ira Kurzban. I encourage you to go to his website. He spells his last name K-U-R-Z-B-A-N. You can see his resume is very long and distinguished. Among other things, he's a past national president and former general counsel of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. He's done a lot of important work in immigration. He also represented the Haitian government under Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and he is closely affiliated with him. He will join us at the bottom of the hour. And my old friend Brian Concannon is on. I'm delighted to have Brian back because he does heroic work. He's a distinguished human rights lawyer. He's the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And if you just Google Brian's name, two N's in Canon, you can go to the website, all kinds of important information on it, including the extraordinary work that Brian does with the Institute. Brian is really up to snuff. I think Ira is as well. I don't know if Ira has been in Haiti recently. Brian, have you been to Haiti since the quake?
I haven't. No, last time I was there was in October.
Well, you sure keep in touch with what's going on with all the work that you do. So why don't we jump right into it? Things for Haitians are always disastrous. They live under the most immense hardships, and then came January 12th and this calamitous quake that hit, and that just added untold misery to the people around Port-au-Prince, maybe 3 million or more, Port-au-Prince and surrounding areas, cities close to it. It's been devastating. Nothing has gone right for Haitians since. From your knowledge, Brian, what is going on there now? The country is occupied. Let me get that in as well. I mean, 20,000 U.S. combat and support troops came in, and I say categorically Haiti is occupied for the duration. I don't see any end to this in sight, probably not for years to come. Oh, Brian, your comments on all this?
Well, the good news is that the aid is starting to get out to people, and the sad news is it took 3 weeks for it to really to be effectively distributed, and in part it was the security concern. As you mentioned, I'm not sure if there's 20,000, but the last I heard it was over 10,000 U.S. soldiers there, plus 9,000 U.N. troops with more of both on the way. And that has actually slowed down the relief efforts. Obviously, you need some security when you're doing a relief effort, but what happened in this case was that the security was made the main mission objective, and that got in the way of distributing aid. It got in the way in two ways. First, the planes were not allowed to land. Planes with urgently needed medical supplies and water and food were not allowed to land because the runway was being used for soldiers. And second, the aid was stockpiled at the airport, and to some extent still is stockpiled at the airport, because people are saying they need 100% security before they can pass the aid out. And that's not justified at all by the facts on the ground. There have been a couple minor incidents at distribution of aid, but most Haitians have been incredibly peaceful in their response. Over and over and again, I hear from people who are working on the ground that what characterizes Haitian response isn't individual looting, individuals trying to get what they just get something for themselves. It's a collective response of people trying to figure out how to get stuff out to the people who need it most. And I think that.
Let me interrupt because we have a break. First off, the Pentagon itself says it plans and probably has now 20,000 troops in the country. If they don't have them all there, they're going to be there. And comparing Haitians to Americans, I don't think Americans would be anywhere near as well comported as Haitians have been.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Given the conditions on the ground around Port-au-Prince and surrounding areas, It's astonishing how well-comported Haitians have been. There are always isolated incidents. A second point that I'd want to make is we didn't come in, the Pentagon, the U.S. military, didn't come in to provide security for ordinary Haitians. They came in to provide security for the tiny percent, oh, the 5 or 10% or so of the population of privileged Haitians, to see to it that they're protected from the great needs of the other 90% or so, who, even though aid is coming in better quantities now, it's still way short of what's needed. And I think the majority of Haitians still are not getting what they need. I don't know how they're surviving, Brian, if two-thirds or more are not getting. I think the OSHA site, the latest OSHA site, says something like one-third of Haitians are getting aid. So what's happening with the other two-thirds? We're talking about, what, a million and a half people not getting aid? What are they doing?
They're getting by through collective response. I think that some, there are some houses and some stores and some, not everything in Port-au-Prince was destroyed. And I think that the people that have things are sharing. There's some small commerce that's working, which is kind of, you know, it's interesting that it takes three weeks to get aid out of the airport a couple miles downtown to Port-au-Prince. But within a day or two, there are actually these, T-Marchand small restaurants and small people selling vegetables and things. They were actually selling within a couple days. And so Haiti's informal economy was what really got it back on its feet, and that's what's saving people. But not everybody has access to that, because even, you know, a lot of the people who have little chicken stands or other food stands, they're selling at cost or as low as they can. But some people don't even have that money, and so there are people who are apparently still starving to death. But most of the Haitians are finding some way of getting at least a little bit of food, enough to keep alive. But
what about drinking water?
The drinking water was the drinking water infrastructure in Port-au-Prince was never very good. It did not get to a lot of places, and my understanding is it's basically inoperative. Drinking water is getting around. I think people are bringing buckets out of cisterns that were in the houses that are still intact. There's some water trucks going around. Some of it is distributed by the international agencies. I think they're probably at somewhere between a third and two-thirds of the population, and the rest are getting by, you know, through the generosity of their neighbors or their own wits. They're finding a way of getting a little bit of water.
The two other big issues are shelter, and I think there is not near enough to go around. But of course, people who have any kind of shelter, it means living in a tent or maybe sleeping on the ground. And the other issue is medical care for the devastating number of injuries. Some absolutely horrific, I guess, amputations, just rampant.
Yes, the medical situation is getting better. A lot of the emergency cases have been treated, but a lot of times that treatment, by the time they were able to get to them, the treatment was amputation. Now what the biggest concern is a wave of secondary infections, people whose wounds are getting infected, because even if once they get immediate treatment, get their bones set, people still have open wounds, and they're living in tents, and those are most of the tents that are available, or the tents are just a cover. It's not a four-sided tent with a floor and a ceiling. It's just a ceiling strung up on a couple poles. And so there's lots of dust and other things are getting in. I think people are getting secondary infections, and I think as the longer people are living outside in very close quarters, the more you're going to get lots of other diseases. So I think it's vital that people get clean water and the ability to bathe, but also that they get to some kind of a more secure, even if it's temporary, housing accommodations.
Brian, the thing that scares me going forward, besides the occupation and the real reason of the U.S. interest in Haiti, which is a lot different than I knew not too long ago, I used to think that the main resource that Haiti had was its cheap, exploitable labor, and indeed that's true. I mean, the vast numbers of Haitians that exploited for near slave wages. But the other issue that I discovered is Haiti apparently is far richer, or potentially far richer, in natural resources. offshore, off the southern shore, potentially extremely, extremely rich oil and gas reserves. Canada is mining in the north, and also the potential for a considerable amount of other resources, coal and gold and uranium and a number of other resources. I wanted to make another point first before I brought that up, and I forgot it. The other point I wanted to make was going forward, we'll never know what the final death toll will be, and I'm thinking a year from now, 2 years from now. Disease is the thing that scares me the most. We will never get a tally of Haitians dying because of disease that wasn't treated. And now you've got people living under such, I mean, the conditions were adverse before, but now they're absolutely impossible living outside with no sanitation. My God, what sanitation can there be? So the threat of disease has to be absolutely appalling, and I can see countless thousands of Haitians dying from disease in the months ahead, but we will never know. It will never be reported, at least officially.
That's true, and I think it's to a large extent with the lack of a basic government infrastructure, it's unreportable. The reason why we're not going to find out, one of the reasons why we're not going to find out, we're never going to be able to know exactly how many people died in the earthquake itself, is that the public health workers who were on the scene were, the best they could do was just load people up in trucks and send them to places where there were mass burials. I heard in some cases they couldn't even do that. They were stacking them up and lighting fires to stacks of corpses. And I expect the same thing is going to happen with people who survived the earthquake but then succumbed to infections because of their living conditions. And that actually raises an important point. This is extremely, obviously, the earthquake itself is an extremely traumatic experience and is going to have a heavy mental health toll on Haitians. But that is compounded by the aid not getting there, by their country being taken over by non-Haitians, but also just by the fact that people are not able to properly mourn and bury their dead. And one response to that, which I thought was really touching, the Aristide Foundation for Democracy and the Bureau des Avocats Nationaux, which is led by my friend Mario Joseph, they had a funeral mass in Titanyen, which is a place where a lot of bodies are being buried. And they said, look, all these people are just being dumped, and there's no closure for the families to mourn them. So we're going to have this mass for all of the dead, where we're going to, they brought up some Protestants, some Catholic ministers, and they had a ceremony to at least in some way commemorate the horrible toll of all these people dead, and give people that aren't dead a sense that their relatives are not being forgotten.
Brian, let me mention this too. On the OSHA site dated yesterday, they say that there will be a vaccination program started, tetanus and diphtheria and rubella, maybe some other things. But this is not the solution. It's a problem. I've done a lot of writing on vaccinations, and I've had a number of programs on them, including twice. I had the world's foremost authority on vaccines, and she is Vera Scheibner is her name, an Australian who came on this program, Brian, at 3:00 in the morning her time, and she said it was important to do and she'd come back anytime. Just amazing. But she, in her writing and her research, is absolutely categorical on this. Vaccines are the problem, not the solution. So many people still don't know that. We're talking about all kinds of vaccines. There are no exceptions. What often happens is these vaccines end up causing the illness they're supposedly designed to prevent. And again, Vieira is absolutely firm on this. She has the seminal book on the topic. She's updating it now, reviewing, I can't believe it, 100,000 pages of medical research and literature, and she's publishing stuff as she goes along. But they can have a mass vaccination program, but it could only end up exacerbating the problem, not helping it. So I know you and I and most of us are not vaccine experts, But this comes straight from the person who's the world's foremost expert. So I think it's important that you know that.
Yeah, that's a symptom of a larger problem, is that Haitians have lost control of their whole lives, and they don't have meaningful decision-making. They don't have meaningful input to a lot of the decisions that are happening. Obviously, you know, their government has been more or less taken over by the United States and by the UN, but just in little ways, such as, you know, obviously where they live, they many can't choose that, and there probably will not be a meaningful choice on these vaccines. There'll probably people will arrive with the vaccines, and they will be people will not be given the information and the time they need to effectively make a decision of an important medical decision. And the same thing you see are happening with children, where there's this. Fortunately, it's been officially halted, although there was an arrest. The arrest a couple days ago makes me think that it's still happening. But the whole idea of taking Haitian children out of the country, and there seems to be this consensus that that's the best thing to do. And I think that I spoke with a psychologist about this over the weekend, but the idea of taking someone who's experienced a huge trauma out of their society is dangerous, but it's also racist, and it's not respecting either the children, their families, or the Haitian culture.
Absolutely, Brian. We've got another break. I have a new article coming tomorrow on child slavery in Haiti. I have a section on those Boise, Idaho-based evangelicals that, as far as I'm concerned, were engaged in trafficking. But we'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm with Brian Concannon, talking about Haiti, of course. Brian, can you stay on for the full program and have an interchange with Ira?
It'd be my pleasure, Steve.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I can just sit back and let you guys kind of lay out the whole thing of what's going on. Oh, my God. Oh, as I said.
Well, one of the great things about having someone like Ira on your show is he's been working on a daily basis on justice for Haiti for, I think, over 30 years. And so he can take you way back to the Duvalier era.
Oh, my goodness. And, of course, he represented Aristide. And I've never had him on before. When we got our signals crossed yesterday, and I thought I couldn't get you on today, I started scurrying like a bunny rabbit trying to think, now, who on earth can I get on? shooting out a few emails, and I managed to get Ira on the phone, and he graciously said he'd come on. He was on a conference call, I think finishing up around now. He said he could join us at the bottom of the hour. But anyway, let's go back to what's going on. And I see terrible things ahead, honestly, Brian. I am very down. As bad as things were before, Haiti will be occupied for the duration, not just by the UN troops. Certainly, I call them paramilitaries in an old article that you inspired me to write. And now we've got the Marines and combat paratroopers. We've got U.S. naval vessels patrolling offshore so that Haitians that want to escape to a friendly area will be intercepted, and they won't be allowed to do it. And if any manage to slip through, they have a lovely facility waiting for them at Guantanamo. So we do not treat Haitians very well, nor have we ever done it.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to know, when you're looking at the earthquake, it was a 7.3 earthquake is obviously a big seismic event. But there was an earthquake of that size in San Francisco a few years ago, and 70 people died. And here in Haiti, you've got over 200,000. Some of that might be explainable by plate tectonics, the fact that the epicenter was close to the surface and close to a city and that kind of thing. But a large percentage of the mortality is purely explicable in social terms. To a large extent, it was a man-made disaster. The majority of people who were killed were living in shanty towns above Port-au-Prince in these poor areas. And they knew that they were dangerous. They knew that the slopes that they were building on were too steep and that the houses were built with substandard construction. But they had no choice. They had to put their family somewhere, and they did not have the opportunity to build in a safer area. And very predictably, when the quake hit, those neighborhoods just completely collapsed and went down the hillside, killing everybody in them. And another thing that, that's important to note is that 20 years ago, those slums weren't existing in Port-au-Prince. And the reason why they've existed since then is because of rural to urban migration, which was to a large extent generated intentionally by policies of the Haitian government, of the U.S. government, and of the United Nations and the international financial institutions, who had made a decision that Haiti's economic salvation lay in assembly manufacture, which required forcing people from the countryside where they could be a captive labor force.
Oh, indeed. And OSHA today says that close to 500,000 are going in a reverse migration out of the area. And one more point on the earthquake, Brian. In one of my articles, I mentioned that the Dominican Republic in 1946 had an 8.1 quake. Oh, my God, 8.1. It only killed 1,600 people. It affected Haiti, but I guess Haiti got some of the fallout. But the Dominican Republic got the worst of it. It only killed 1,600, so they were much better prepared than Haiti was. Haiti was very, very vulnerable, and they knew about it in advance. But those who could do something did absolutely nothing. And, of course, poor Haitians, Brian, as you know, they do what they can. They live what they can under whatever conditions they're able. And given how little they have, they're not able. Their ability isn't very great.
It isn't, and the medical crisis that you're seeing is to a large extent the result of not having any excess capacity, not even having anywhere near sufficient capacity. You know, as you mentioned, Haiti was a disaster on January 11th, and someone asked me, well, why don't you have doctors rushing in from the countryside to Port-au-Prince? And I said, well, because there aren't any doctors in the countryside. And the ones that were, they did rush, but it was not an effective number because Haiti has one of the lowest doctor to population ratios of anywhere in the world, by far the lowest in the Western Hemisphere. And even those doctors are highly concentrated in Port-au-Prince, where people can afford to pay for health care. And so there just wasn't that much in the system even to deal with the day-to-day health needs of the Haitian people, and it was completely overwhelmed by this disaster, as it's overwhelmed by any kind of stress, which I think is another thing to remember. I mean, your listeners have heard enough of these cycles that you go through, and a year and a half ago it was tropical storms. 6 years ago, in 2004 was a tropical storm, but it was also a coup d'etat. I mean, Haiti keeps over and over having these disasters that are, some are economic, some are political, some are natural, and the common thread of all of those is that Haiti just doesn't have the capability to withstand any kind of a stress. And the solution isn't to stop earthquakes, because that's not going to happen. The solution is the same thing that works in any country that has managed to escape extreme vulnerability. It's to develop a basic government structure that can provide the services so that people are not so vulnerable.
And the only time they had it was in the 1990s under Aristide, and of course two coups to oust him, 91 under Senior Bush and 2004 under Junior Bush, and he's the man that Haitians so badly want back now. And of course, Washington won't let him come. Another break, Brian, and then we'll have Ira join us.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Maybe Carrie will cue me. Ira, are we connected? Oh, okay. very informal on this program, Brian. glitches and all. Republic Broadcasting had a glitch this morning. Their website went down, so anybody trying to access past archives will go to the website. It's not working. Well, I guess technology can be great when it works, but when it doesn't work, it's not so great. Anyway, they have a tech whiz, and he's coming in later to fix things. But let's go back to where we were, Brian. Pick up with more on what you can pass on conditions overall and what Haitians face. The conditions are always so appalling. And it's amazing that that Haitians can somehow persist and go on, and they have for so many decades, centuries, and they go on, and the spirit of wanting to have a nation governed the way all nations should be governed, that spirit never dies. And of course, they had it in the 1990s under Aristide. And if he were to come back, which I think is impossible because Washington won't let him, that alone would be such an uplift to the Haitian people that if you wanted to come to, if anybody's worried about any kind of turbulence going on in the streets, they could put that out of their mind if Aristide were allowed to come back. Ira, are we connected now?
Yeah, I could hardly hear you, though.
Oh, my goodness. Gary, you want to disconnect and try again?
No, if you speak up a little bit, I'll be fine.
Oh, okay. Well, I can hear you. I would say you're slightly on the faint side, but I can hear you fine. I'm on with Brian Concannon. I wanted to keep you both on, but I explained your background and how you represented the Aristide government and Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And Brian mentioned that you've been involved in work in Haiti for the past 30 years. So let me let you jump in and talk and give your perspective on what's happening there now.
Well, I think the situation obviously is quite a bit different than the way it's pictured in the mainstream media in the U.S. I think the situation on the ground is awful for, you know, the vast majority of people. No place to live, very, very little food, very, very little water. I think tensions are running very high. The Haitian government really, unfortunately, hasn't been able to deliver on very much other than clearing the streets of bodies. And I think there's kind of a vacuum of leadership that has been taken over to a large extent by the United States and the U.N.
Well, very definitely. I'm unequivocal, Ira. I've written a number of articles since the quake. And there's no question in my mind that Haiti is an occupied country. It was under the U.S., under the U.N. so-called peacekeepers, I call them paramilitaries. They've been very belligerent ever since they came in around April 2004 after the February coup. But now we've got U.S. combat troops in force. And my knowledge of the way this country operates around the world going back so many decades everywhere is we're there for the duration.
I think the other aspect of it is that most Americans may be unaware of is they've really kind of locked down Haiti in the sense that American foreign policy toward Haiti has always been driven to a large extent by the fear of Haitians leaving Haiti and coming to the U.S. And part of that has to do with institutionalized racism within the, you know, within the immigration bureaucracy and the intelligence bureaucracy. You know, this concept that people are going to get on boats and come here seems frightening to many people, although historically, we have been much, much more generous to other groups of refugees. So the country now is in kind of a lockdown mode where we have Coast Guard cutters circling the Windward Passage, making sure nobody can leave. We obviously have UN and U.S. troops stationed in appropriate places to prevent people from, you know, leaving the country. And I think that's right. I mean, I think it is occupied, but it's occupied primarily, in my view at least, not as a humanitarian mission, but to make sure people can't get out.
Well, and also to protect.
I think when you contrast the treatment that we have accorded other people in far less dire situations, one can only come to the conclusion that racism plays a factor here because we flew 250,000 Cubans into the United States in 1965 to have an orderly departure program. We allowed, as you know, another 125,000 Cubans to come from Mariel. We've brought in what amounted to hundreds of thousands of Indochinese refugees into the United States and allowed them to stay here. So the question is, why aren't we engaged in the same kind of generous program toward Haitians? There are many things that we can do to bring in many, many people into the country if we chose to do that. And that is a matter not of any technical problem. It's really a matter of political will.
And Ira, we only grudgingly just gave 30,000 Haitians, mostly in South Florida, temporary protected status after many months of people working so hard to get it. And even, I mean, under these conditions, it really is a no-brainer. And yet it honestly came grudgingly and only given for 18 months. My God, this disaster is going to go on for years.
Yeah.
Brian,
and I'm not only talking about the people here. I'm talking about our capacity to bring people to the United States. For example, we know that there are about 55,000 people in Haiti who family members have petitioned for them in the United States, who have approved petitions and they're sitting in Haiti. Another 10 or 15,000 are people who file petitions here in the United States for their family members in Haiti. We could easily bring that 65 or 70,000 group to the United States. They're eventually going to come anyway. Why aren't we paroling them in? Because we would have the benefit of allowing an orderly departure, relieving problems in Haiti, and unifying people with their family members.
After devastating hurricanes, I think in the 1980s, hit Honduras, Nicaragua, Nicaraguan earthquake also, something 100,000 to 200,000 people from those countries were brought in, given protected status. And you're right, racism is a major situation in the way we treat Haitians. With Cubans, we had a law that went back to the 1960s, I think amended to be a so-called wet foot, dry foot policy. You're familiar with this stuff. Any Cuban that makes it to U.S. shores is I guess, inspected to be sure they're not bringing some terrible disease or something. And then they're admitted that any Haitian who comes in is either put in detention or sent off, in the past sent off to Guantanamo, or sent home again.
Right.
So this is a terrible policy.
And to show you the kind of mentality of all this, the major detention center here in South Florida, part of it was cleared out with the expectation that they would be incarcerating Haitians if they tried to come to the U.S. And this policy is so different than how we treat Cubans and others who arrive in less dire circumstances. You know, as I said, we brought over 250,000 Cubans. We flew them into the United States in 1965 and 1966 just to prevent, you know, another boat lift from leaving Cuba. We said, okay, we're going to take the initiative and we're going to go to Cuba. We're going to inspect people before they get on those planes and we're going to bring them here. And we brought 250,000 people here that way. We haven't, the only thing we've done with Haiti is to say, we're going to put Coast Guard cutters around the country to prevent people from leaving instead of developing an orderly process in which we can bring large numbers of people into the U.S.
Very definitely. Brian, let me let you jump in.
Well, I think that it's that the problem is containing Haitians, but it's also containing the ideology. We were talking back before about how this has been a long history of Haitians always, of the U.S. always intervening on the Haitian inside Haiti. And I think part of it is, as you mentioned, natural resources. It goes back to tropical hardwoods back in the 30s up through the oil and mineral resources now. But I think there's also been an effort to contain ideology, and that's they have not allowed Haiti to function as a government, either in 1804 as a government run by freed slaves, or in 2004 as a government run by a progressive administration. And I think that they also want to keep Haitians out of the United States because they don't want more progressive people, especially going to Florida.
And Haiti has always been a country that one of many, but the poorer the country is, the more vulnerable it is, and the more we target it to be exploited. Ira, I discovered in fairly recent weeks that I used to think Haiti had really no value other than its people to be exploited as near slave labor. But I discovered that Haiti is potentially extremely rich in resources, including what the U.S. goes after most, oil and gas, but also coal and copper and uranium, gold. So the occupation is also to bring in the corporate predators and let them take full advantage of this. Canada is up in the north, has mining operations, I think, for coal. And I have a feeling that the country is going to be carved up among the corporate predators from different countries, Canada getting a piece, and France, I'm sure, wants a piece, and the U.S. most of all wants the oil. And this is the way Haiti will be treated, and that's another reason why the Marines are there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's always been an issue over the resources in Haiti, and there was some feeling, I think, in 2004 that the coup against President Aristide was also motivated by the desire to get people out of the way who might object to carving up the country. And, you know, Aristide being a populist leader and the Lavalas Party being a party based on self-determination of the Haitian people and their right to keep their own resources, you know, had to be eliminated in order to have this step. And, you know, this is the classic kind of situation where using an event like the earthquake, you know, this is consistent with a number of theories that say, you know, this kind of shock capitalism where they use an event like this as a way of pushing forward and, you know, in this case, carving up the country, but using a traumatic event to bring in troops to secure the country and then secure the resources.
I
wouldn't be a bit surprised if that began with as part of the overall plan, just as we saw in the overall plan in Iraq, was to privatize everything and put it in the hands of foreign corporations.
Oh, absolutely. Destroy local business operations and turn all agriculture over to agribusiness. Oh, I haven't written much about Iraq recently, but I sure wrote an awful lot about it the past 2-3 years. the story is just so utterly horrific, and you get these fairy tales reported in through the major media. And the Haitian story, of course, has been so grossly misreported, and now it's quickly fading from the news, except, again, these fiction reports about things are slowly getting back to normal, or we're really bringing in the aid, and people are being helped. I mean, the truth is that, sure, there's more getting in, and a certain number of people are getting some things. But as Brian explained, to a great extent, Haitians are getting by cooperating with each other. They're certainly not getting much of any help from the U.S., and the U.N. is hamstrung because the U.S. controls everything. They control the distribution points into the country, the port areas, whatever is operating, and, of course, the airport. So stuff stacks up there and it isn't getting in. And there was an awful lot of complaints by the aid agencies. I'm not sure how complaining they are right now, but Doctors Without Borders and Paul Farmer's group, I mean, stuff just not getting in the amounts needed to be able to help people. And we're talking about millions of people in need.
No, I think that's right, and I always marvel at, you know, they're saying the need for these troops because there's going to be violence. I mean, if this was a comparable situation in New York City or Washington, you know, my view is people would be shooting at themselves. You know?
Oh, they would. Oh, it would be mass riots.
And that the level of violence would be much, much higher in the United States. I mean, I think under the circumstances, what you're seeing is what Brian said. I think you're seeing Haitians cooperate with one another, work together, you know, rather than this notion that there was going to be violence and that's why we needed 12,000 U.S. troops and 12,000 United Nations troops on the ground there. And the reality is that there's far less need for troops than there are for bringing in humanitarian supplies to people.
Absolutely. Brian, I want to let you jump back in, but in one of my articles I wrote about what we did in 1947-48, the Berlin airlift, with capabilities far, far less than we have today. When we cranked that up, we were delivering 5,500 tons daily to 2 million people in West Berlin. If we could do that then, we could probably deliver five times that much now easily to the people of Haiti, but we're not doing it. We're simply sitting on our hands. In plain English, we don't give a damn about the poor people of Haiti. That's what it always comes to. We don't give a damn about the poor people in the USA, so why should we give a damn about them in Haiti? We don't. A terrible situation. Brian, I mean, you're involved in this all the time, and you see it, and I'm sure you're frustrated as well.
Yeah, it's part of a pattern. Obviously, Berlin's a lot closer to the United States, or Haiti's a lot closer to the United States than Berlin is. It's just about an hour and a half flight from Miami. It's closer from Guantanamo Bay and Puerto Rico. I mean, there are great assets that the United States has very near to Haiti, and the aid could have been delivered much quicker. And I think the only two reasons why it was, one was that the militarization took priority, and I think the second was that, as you mentioned, it's part of a very consistent history of us not supporting the urgent needs of Haiti's poor.
And the easy way to have done it would have been to airdrop stuff in, scattered around where people need it, and you can get enough people on the ground to handle the stuff coming in. And if Haitians knew they were going to be helped, did the order, there'd be no rioting. Let's take one more break, and we'll come back to the last segment.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Final segment with Brian Concannon, Ira Kurzban. Let me let you both jump in, either one fine, and we've got a few minutes left for any final important comments. Who wants to start?
I'll defer to Ira if he's still on, but if he's not,
yeah,
I'll add my comment.
I wanted to just pick up on something that, Brian had mentioned before. This idea that somehow Haitians need, U.S. troops there and need the United Nations troops there to, maintain some kind of stability just is a real myth, I think, in many respects. What people need or in this kind of situation is they need aid and assistance. And, obviously we'd urge all the callers to channel that into the appropriate places, but what you need is aid and assistance going to the grassroots organizations that are doing work in Haiti on the ground, helping people on a daily basis. And I think, and these should be groups that are really Haitian-led and Haitian-directed, because one of the fears, of course, is that they will turn all government responsibilities over to NGOs, international NGOs,
will wind up running the country and determining what's best for the Haitian people, when what we should be working on is how best to empower the Haitian people to do what they do best, which is to work in a cooperative way by getting them the tools that they need. One of the things that I learned in representing Haiti over the many years, you know, for many years it was said that Haiti got $2 billion in aid and it's a failed state, and, you know, why should we keep giving aid to a country that doesn't do very much with it? And I started to check into it, and one of the things I found in that, you know, so-called $2 billion number, half a billion of it was to interdict Haitians and to take them to Guantanamo. And another 80% of it really went back to U.S. companies. I think most Americans do not understand that when we give foreign aid, the basis for giving that foreign aid is the argument in front of members of Congress that 80% of it goes back to American companies. What we need to do is have a different view of how our aid is given by figuring out how to give aid directly. And that is either aid directly, as for example, countries sending doctors directly to assist the Haitian people or to train future generations of doctors, or giving aid directly to grassroots organizations to empower them. What typically happens now is we give huge amounts of money to companies like, the multinational companies that work with the military, Brown and Root and companies like that. They then hire people local. They take a huge amount off the top, hire companies that in turn take a huge amount off the top. And what you really have is kind of trickle-down economics. So the United States is spending hundreds of millions of dollars, but very, very little assistance is going to the Haitian people.
Absolutely.
And this is an opportunity for this administration to rethink that whole process of how we give assistance and to try and give assistance directly to the Haitian people.
Indeed, Ira. Brian, I apologize we didn't get your last comments. We're out of time. I thank you both for coming on. It was a special program for me to have you both on. Oh, the Haiti story isn't going away. I certainly will keep on it. Thank you very much to both of you. And join us again tomorrow. We will have another topic, another important topic, with a distinguished guest,